This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Ferguson, Cleveland, Staten Island, North Charleston, Baltimore. The names of the cities now sadly roll off the tongue, but they're not the only places where police engage in confrontations with residents. The hope and plan is for law enforcement to avoid the kinds of situations that might call for the use of restraint or deadly force. These interactions, where tensions are de-escalated and violence is avoided, don't make the front page, and they happen daily. But in the moments where conflict does happen, hard-earned community trust can quickly erode. So how are police being trained to handle their weapons, to give chase, to control a violent situation? How do other countries train their police? Today, Where We Live, we'll talk with police trainers and experts, and we'd like you to join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Again, our phone number is 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Coming up later, The Washington Post's Emily Badger will tell us how Baltimore became Baltimore. But first, let me welcome in Anthony Salvatore, who's chief of police for the town of Cromwell. He's chairman of the Police Officer Standards and Training Council for the state of Connecticut. Chief Salvatore, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we get into some of the specifics of police training that I really want to get to, from your perception as you watch what's happening around the country, in some cases around the world, as someone who trains police, what do you think? What do you see?
Well, definitely a lot more scrutiny now on law enforcement, and part of it is because of the 24-hour news cycle and the fact that we're able now in a matter of moments to be across country and learning what's occurring now in California and those types of situations. But in some cases, it is disturbing as far as some of these incidences, and also in some cases the way the incidences are being handled.
When you see a police officer out of your jurisdiction somewhere else in the country do something that clearly you think is a bad bit of behavior, what does it mean for you as a police officer here in your community?
Well, the problem is when you have a situation as you described, the public is now looking and watching and wondering, is that occurring here in Connecticut or in my community? And those are the types of situations that you have to deal with. And sometimes those are the types of situations you have to deal with basically on a community level, whether it's a town council or a board of selectmen's meeting where the citizens show up and wondering if those, you know, could possibly occur here and what type of training or what type of policies you may have in place locally.
How much training in what exact type of training does a police officer have to get in Connecticut? Explain a little bit of some of the requirements for us.
Sure. To be a police officer, a certified police officer in the state of Connecticut, 880 hours of academy training followed up by a minimum of 400 hours of field training. And by that, I mean they actually go to the academy or to one of our satellite academies and spend approximately 24 weeks, 880 hours learning constitutional law, Connecticut law, laws of arrest, how to drive, pursuit driving, firing a firearm, et cetera, those types of situations, de-escalation of situations. They basically, are trained how to be police officers. And from there, they go back to their respective departments and put in another 400 hours at a minimum with a veteran officer or officers, as the case may be, to be evaluated and to learn specifically the policies and procedures, rules, regulations of the jurisdictions they will be patrolling.
What's the breakdown of the hours? And I don't need you to get specific down to the hour, but when it comes to the amount of time, say, someone learns to shoot their weapon or to drive in pursuit versus time spent de-escalating, figuring out how to just do interpersonal communications, what's the breakdown of the time of the training?
Well, it all varies. For instance, criminal investigations is approximately 15 hours. Criminal law is 145 hours. Introduction to law enforcement, 32 hours. Law enforcement practices, 192 hours. They also learn are certified as medical response technicians, which is another 60 hours. patrol procedures, 111 hours and so on until you hit 880 hours. I believe driving is another 40 hours and firearms is 40 to 50 hours.
Does it feel like the balance is right to you? As someone who's trained police for years, do you think that the breakdown of the amount of time spent doing various things is right? Do you think that we should have more training in some things versus others?
Well, we're always one thing that the council does, the Police Officer Standards and Training Council post, we are always constantly reevaluating and changing our curriculum to respond to you know, today's technologies and circumstances. For instance, there's a call to add recommendation of adding 6 hours for fair and impartial policing, a course taught that's being taught around the country. So we're looking at that. In our next council meeting, which is next Thursday, we will be considering adding 6 more hours to our curriculum.
When you say fair and impartial policing, what do you mean?
Well, you know, it's how officers interact with the community to make sure that there's a correct balance between their jobs and what they're doing in the law. And, you know, a lot of the individuals we are getting are for the most part, directly out of college. A lot of college individuals or military. So you want to make sure that they have the bases to deal with the general public.
We're talking with Anthony Salvatore, who's the chief of police for the town of Cromwell. He's also chairman of the Police Officer Standards and Training Council for the state of Connecticut. We're talking about police training on the program today, and we want you to join the conversation at 860-275-7266. I want to bring in Dennis Tuller, who's a retired police lieutenant and police trainer. He's in Salt Lake City, Utah. He's trained thousands of men and women throughout the world, including law enforcement officers, SWAT teams. And Dennis Tuller, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
When you hear about the Connecticut standards for police training from Chief Salvatore, does that sound about the same as what other officers in other states are required to do?
Yes, I think you'll find that most agencies, most departments try to cover as broad a spectrum as they can, given the time and resources available.
Do you think that really police officers should have more training than that before they get out on the beat?
It's always a balancing act, and decisions have to be made at some level as to, are we going to keep these officers in training for another week, 2 weeks, a month, because that's all time that they're not available on the street to be out there handling calls and trying to solve problems. It's additional money because they're on, you know, the clock is ticking, the salary is running. Yes, it's wonderful when we can do more and better training. I can't help but add in something here that's constantly on the back of my mind, is that no one seems to be training the public as to how to interact with the police.
Tell me more about that.
Well, a lot of these high-profile cases that have been in the news and that have led to all this conflict and rioting, if you look at those cases... from this perspective, that when the officer looked at these individuals and said, "Sir, you are under arrest," had that person simply turned around, put his hands behind his back, submitted to a lawful arrest, and then sorted out the issues in court, that's how the system is supposed to work. And none of these would have turned into headlines if that had been the way the things had played out.
Of course, one of the questions that many people have is the police purview and decision-making that goes into asking someone to stop and put their hands behind their back. In the case of Freddie Gray in Baltimore, we have a situation where, from everything we understand, someone made eye contact with an officer and decided to flee. Maybe we can get into some of the specific, maybe hypotheticals or situations that you train with, Dennis Tuller, but what happens there? Someone runs away, and they're not necessarily a suspect in any ongoing investigation. What are police trained to do?
Well, again, officers have a great deal of discretion, and if someone runs from a police officer, that can be a clue. I mean, should that heighten the officer's alertness to this particular person? You stop to talk to three individuals, and one of them looks at you and runs away. Do you let him go, or do you find out why he's running away? Is he a wanted homicide suspect? or is he just afraid of the police? Clearly, officers can choose to act on or ignore the behavior that they see, but someone who runs from the police, that would seem to me to be an indicator of that there's some additional suspicion that would be reasonable there.
Chief Salvatore, could you maybe elaborate on that for me? How are officers in Connecticut trained to handle a situation like that? Someone is, again, not a suspect in anything, but they run away from the police. What do you train your cops to do?
Well, certainly I agree with the lieutenant, and it's a balancing act, and each situation is a case-by-case basis. But if you have a situation and you stop, as the lieutenant stated, and you stop to talk to several individuals and one of them bolts, the officer certainly has a right to reasonably detain an individual to determine if, in fact, a crime was committed. And those are the situations that we do train our officers. But it's a balancing act, and I agree with the lieutenant and communicating to the public. And maybe in some of these incidences around the country, had the police leadership along with the civic leadership been more transparent and gotten the word out a lot quicker as to some of the situations which occurred, maybe some of these situations could have been avoided.
Mm. And if you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Let's go to the phones. Josh is calling from Hartford. Hi, Josh. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hello, and hello to the two officers. I wanted to talk a little bit. I'm a public defender, and so you can take what I say with a grain of salt, of course. But I recently participated in a program where officers and juvenile justice-involved teenagers got to meet and talk about their interactions and try to build some trust here in Connecticut. And one of the things that all the officers told me was that their number one priority, this is, I presume, sort of part of training, their number one priority is to come home at the end of a shift.
Amen.
And that, which, I mean, makes sense. I suppose everyone's number one priority is not to die during the day. But I sense this pervasive sense among officers that their job is extraordinarily dangerous. And I know that in their training, they're trained to look at every interaction sort of as a tactical interaction, one where someone could be reaching for a gun or a weapon. Now, that makes sense to a degree, but practically speaking, all the other people who live in high-crime neighborhoods where those officers patrol don't get that luxury. They don't get to say to someone, show me your hands because you make me nervous. But officers are trained to do that, and they're trained to see danger. And I get the sense that that affects their whole perception of the neighborhoods where they work. Most people don't have a gun or a knife and aren't going to do anything wrong. But when police approach them, even for something as minor as a noise complaint, and say, show me your hands or get up against the wall, the tenor, the tone that sets is one of distrust and one of fear. And I presume that it has to put officers on edge. They're trained to be on edge in a way that can't be healthy.
Mm. Josh, thank you very much. And Josh, public defenders, Josh Mictum, who we've had on the program before, and thank you for your phone call. Dennis Tuller, would you like to respond?
Yes, and that is always back to the Balancing Act concept. Officers realize that the vast majority of people that they deal with are not criminals, they're not bad guys, and they're not going to try to hurt them. The other side of that coin is you only have to be wrong once to have that be the last mistake you ever make. So, yes, always in the back of our mind is that anyone you contact might be the one who suddenly pulls a knife, who suddenly decides to pull a trigger, who suddenly decides to swerve that car or back into you as you're approaching on the traffic stop. That has to be in the back of your mind. That has to be part of your training. An officer must believe that it will happen to him or her, and have one of the things we try to teach is the appropriate mindset and to be alert to your environment and to try to recognize and respond to danger cues. And if we do a good job of that, we can often recognize a potential problem, use distance, use cover, and avoid a potential confrontation.
And if I may, I definitely agree with the counselor and the lieutenant. There's a way to approach people. It's, you know, and all in the manner in which you talk to people. But listen, we had two end of watches this weekend. End of watch, two officers that gave their lives. Again, doing their jobs. They wanted to go home at the end of their shifts, and it's unfortunate they did not go home at the end of their shifts. And that always weighs very heavily on all our law enforcement officers. You never know what to expect, but we try to train them to expect the unexpected. But it also comes down to how you deal with people, because the vast majority of individuals, as you stated, you know, are not doing something that's illegal. But unfortunately, officers have to be on guard all the time for the unexpected. And it's unfortunate we lost two more over the weekend.
I think what our caller Josh was getting at, too, Chief, is in part what's playing into some of the tensions happening in a lot of urban areas right now, which is if people feel that police may indeed stop them, detain them, handcuff them for no particular reason, maybe even put them on their way, but maybe put them back into the criminal justice system for some minor offense, it might lead them to then necessarily flee a scene, which is what happens. And then you get into a cycle where, you know, if you feel as though the police don't treat you well, then you might avoid a confrontation with police. You run, and then a confrontation with police might escalate beyond the place where either the person or the police want it. It seems though this mindset somehow or other is creating a cycle right now that's causing more problems than solutions.
It definitely is, and that's why now in the state of Connecticut, as a result of legislation last year, Post was mandated to come up with a policy by June 2015, which we're putting the wraps on at our council meeting next week to address citizen complaints statewide so that we have a uniform policy throughout the state for all law enforcement agencies. That's why we're also looking at body cams, both in the legislature as well as from the council standpoint. I've commissioned a subcommittee within the council to take a look at a policy for addressing body cams. And all this goes into what you're saying, because people, you know, are feeling that when they've been wronged, maybe there's a case where after filing a complaint, their complaints aren't being fully addressed. So we're looking to address that more appropriately also.
We have a couple of phone callers I want to get to, but I just have to ask you quickly. You mentioned body cams. There's a piece of legislation right now going through the legislature that took up an awful lot of issues surrounding this, but actually a provision to equip police with body cams across Connecticut was taken out of that. Does your organization that you represent, do you support the use of body cameras on all Connecticut police officers?
Well, I also do legislative I'm also legislative co-chair for the Connecticut Police Chiefs Association, we supported Senator Looney's proposal, which was the pilot program, as well, you know, to try it, and then as well as putting together a policy. I think that needs to be an individual or department decision, maybe the pilot program is going to tell us otherwise. Certainly, if the funding's there, it's a lot easier to put that on to each department. And there was a proposal of $15 million within the bond package for, I believe, 2017 to supply each officer in the state of Connecticut with a body cam. But we want to make sure we do it the right way. And, you know, as far as storage and what we will be releasing and how it will be released, because then it also comes down to no matter what we do, it's also FOI, and we want to be able to protect individuals' rights. Just because we filmed it, we're concerned that it doesn't necessarily mean that we release it.
Yeah, FOI, of course, Freedom of Information, what would be available from these body camera tapes. Let's just quickly go to a phone call here. Derek's calling from Windsor. Hello, Derek. You're on Where We Live.
Hey, John. Good to talk to you again. I want to say one of your guests there touched on it a little bit. And all over the news, I've been hearing the respect the cops, respect the cops. I'm not hearing cops must respect us as citizens. And I want to know what happened to that. I personally have had incident with cops where they just come up and disrespect me. I'm a hard-working, tax-paying person, never committed a crime. And he disrespect me. And when you do that, what do you expect to get from citizens? And the other thing is that I agree with the training. But it doesn't matter how much training, John. If you don't adhere to the rules, what good is the training? And I think the biggest part of this is accountability. When the cops step out of line, they need to be held to accountability. And unless that happens, this thing is just deja vu all over again. But one of the big issues, like I said, respect. You got to respect the citizen if you're looking for respect from them. I learned as a Jamaican that respect is earned. And if you just come up to me and disrespect me, guess what? I am going to disrespect you, too. So that's my point, John, and I thank you for taking my call.
And thank you very much for your phone call, Derek. And Dennis Tueller, maybe quickly before our break, you can respond to Derek, because I think an awful lot of citizens, in response to what you said about complying with police, respecting the authority of police, they're saying, well, if police act with some of the same responsibility, some of the same respect, then indeed individuals will react in the proper way. But they don't always feel as though they're getting the same respect from police officers that police expect from them.
Well, clearly, law enforcement officers are we serve the public. That's our job and our goal, and the training certainly includes interacting with the public. I can't speak to any individual situations where I wasn't present as to how someone was treated, but I will say this, that the respect pendulum swings both ways as well. And many times officers are going into what they perceive to be enemy territory. How many times does an officer respond to a situation where the first reaction in the neighborhood, in the apartment building, in the home he approaches is disrespect and catcalls and cursing and after you're spat upon and having things thrown at you.
But if I might just, sir, isn't the mindset that you might be going into enemy territory part of the problem, part of the fact is the officer's there to not only protect all of those people who want to work with the officer, but to protect all those people who might catcall the officer, people who might not respect the officer, but he or she is there to protect those folks as well. The idea that you'd go into enemy territory seems as though that might be a mindset that could be set up for some problems.
And why do you suppose they believe it's enemy territory? Because they're treated like the enemy. Again, this has to work both ways. You look at policing in this country, we have a unique system in this country. We have a constitution, we have laws and rules and regulations. Officers must have probable cause before they stop, they frisk, they search. We have to have warrants. We have in some countries, if a police officer stops you and says, I want to see your identification, and you ask what for, you're going to find your face on the pavement and someone putting the boots to you, and you'll be trying to explain your way out of a jail cell. Again, police have a lot of authority, and we have to temper that, and all people on both sides need to be held accountable for their actions. But it's pretty hard for law enforcement officers as human beings to ignore the treatment they receive.
Anthony Salvatore, before we take a break, I'd like for you to jump in.
Yeah, I'm not sure I on this one necessarily agree with the lieutenant. You have to deal with each situation on a case by case basis, and our officers should go into a situation and of course be always on guard. But the bottom line is they should treat individuals with respect, and until of course the individuals they're dealing with are being disrespectful, but at the very least, our officers should always treat individuals with respect and, when possible, explain what they're doing and hopefully de-escalate a situation rather than escalate a situation.
And we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking more about de-escalation and talking with someone who's studied how police departments around the world handle situations like this, including training for de-escalation. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today on the program, we're talking about police training with Anthony Salvatore, who's chief of police for the town of Cromwell. He's also chairman of the Police Officer Standards and Training Council for the state of Connecticut. Also on the line with us is Dennis Tueller, who's a retired police lieutenant and police trainer. I want to bring into the conversation Dr. Maria Haberfeld, who's professor and chair of the Department of Law, Police Science, and Criminal Justice Administration at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City. Maria, welcome to the program. Thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
How do training requirements in the U.S. compare to those of other countries?
Well, unfortunately, they don't compare well. Average training of a police agency in the United States, somewhere in 16, 17 weeks. Other countries, for example, Finland, Germany, they have an actual degree in police science before officers are allowed to police on the streets. So we have a very inefficient training in comparison to European countries.
How do you see this playing out? I mean, we're talking about the situation right now because, frankly, of a series of high-profile cases of police-involved killings. However, if you look at the numbers worldwide, how does the U.S. stack up when it comes to the way it interacts with individuals, the number of times that deadly force is used? What can you tell us about those numbers, Maria?
Well, you know, it's really not about numbers because it's you know, we're talking about 18,000 different police forces in the United States versus countries in Europe that are national or somewhat decentralized, but not like ours. Our system. So you know, the way we collect the numbers in comparison to Europe is not a good comparison, in addition to the fact that, you know, people in the United States are heavily armed. So we cannot compare the situations. But, you know, I don't necessarily think that what's happening right now, what happened, for example, the other day in Mississippi where two police officers are killed is actually, somewhat related to training. It's, you know, police traffic stops are the most difficult situation, the most dangerous situations. This would have happened regardless of the amount of training. But for me, from my perspective, again, it's about looking at police training from a completely different perspective, looking at emotional intelligence, social intelligence, change intelligence. This type of training that emphasizes your self-control, other people's control or lack of control, understanding the necessity to move from something that you trained in and trying to apply something different in a nanosecond, in a split of a second. These are very complex and complicated topics. And, you know, and in my mind, our police officers certainly deserve more, and these are the most, you know, courageous men and women out there trying to protect others, and we owe them as a democratic society, we owe them much more than what we're giving them right now.
And when you say we owe them much more, we owe them more training, more of the type of training that you're talking about.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
We got a tweet from someone, Jenny Lee says, Connecticut requires 1,500 hours of training to become a hairdresser. Police need more training and screening. I'm wondering, Chief, how you might respond to some of this, because obviously the training that Connecticut officers undergo is in many ways extensive. It's not as much as you'd get for something else. We heard Dennis Tuller say, look, there's considerations. People want to put feet on the streets, which means sometimes we want to rush people through training. What do you say to Maria's point?
Well, first of all, law enforcement officers are always in training. Here in Connecticut, even after you're certified, every 3 years you got to go back for a minimum of 60 hours certified training, which usually ends up being a lot more than that every 3 years. I have to disagree, though, on a point here. We don't know yet if the situation in Mississippi was as a result of poor training or the officers didn't follow their training upon approaching that motor vehicle. So it's really premature. The other thing, besides training, we're missing one of the extremely important elements, and that's our selection process. You got to have a good selection process to look for the best qualified individuals to be police officers. And that's another thing here in Connecticut we are extremely proud of. To be a law enforcement officer in Connecticut, you can't have a felony. You can't have an A and B misdemeanor. It requires a psychological test, a polygraph test, a complete background, drug screening, physical agility. I'm not sure exactly what it is in other states, but I know that we go through an extensive, rigorous background for all officers to get on the job here in Connecticut, and that's extremely important. And that's the first thing when we start looking for officers, because we want the best qualified men and women to be out there protecting us.
I want to go to Aaron, who's calling from Manchester. Hi, Aaron. Go ahead.
Hi, I wanted to, thanks for taking my call, but I wanted to address some of the earlier comments by, I believe it's the lieutenant that's on the phone. I really feel like he's speaking from a place of privilege and not understanding necessarily the community that he's serving. If a black youth can end up in the back of a police van for committing no crime and not being under arrest and no suspicion of committing a crime, and he can end up dead, the other youths in that neighborhood, what message does that send to them? It's a message of distrust from the police. And so, of course, if they're not doing anything wrong, they're going to run away from that situation. And so I feel like he's not really addressing that there is something that has to be done on the behalf of the law enforcement that helped break that cycle.
Yeah, Dennis Tuller, maybe you could respond to Aaron in Manchester, and thank you for your call, Aaron.
Certainly. If the kinds of incidents she's describing are occurring, then those officers are clearly acting outside their authority. You can't stop someone without probable cause. You can't take someone into custody without probable cause. Should there be oversight of the police? Absolutely. I've been on both sides of that coin. I've been in situations where we worked diligently to get officers removed from the job because of misbehavior on their part. I can't help but keep going back to the fact that if some people in some communities are raised to believe that the police are the enemy, that that the police are to be hated and distrusted, it's hard for the officers to be trained to the point to overcome someone else's attitude.
And I think Aaron's point is that this isn't about people growing up mistrusting the police because they're taught that way. It's because in the case that she talks about, they're seeing with their own eyes something that they wish was different. You know, so this isn't about growing up wanting to hate the police. This is actually seeing things, even if it's a few things, that make them mistrust.
And I've seen that too. There's no question or doubt about it. Police are human beings, and as they say, power can corrupt, and absolute power can corrupt absolutely. And police abuses of power should not be tolerated.
I want to get to Regina in Naugatuck. Hi, Regina. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. I just have a comment. I think that we need to lose the word respect. I really believe that we should use courtesy instead. We should all be courteous toward one another. But I can't respect someone if I don't know them. And if they haven't earned it, I just think that we put too much emphasis on that word.
Regina, thank you for that. And actually, I guess this is something I was talking with you about during the break, Anthony Salvatore, which is respect is something that we talk about, but because it is so amorphous, respect means something different to me than it does to you. People grow up with different types of respect in their minds. We heard from Derek, who grew up in Jamaica, for whom respect might mean something very different than someone who grew up in Hartford. Do you take her point that maybe courtesy is something that we can have as a standard, but respect is something that's maybe far beyond our ability to actually do on a case-by-case basis?
I agree with that somewhat. And again, on behalf of the officers, it's how they approach the situation and how they're handling it and the attitude they're coming across with. But again, it depends. It's a case-by-case type of situation. Depends on what they're dealing with. But at the very least, until otherwise, individuals should comply with the law enforcement's orders. And then if it's something that they feel that they've been wronged, then I believe that they should file complaints, and those complaints should be thoroughly investigated. I don't want a bad cop on the job working for me. I want good officers. I want the best people that I could possibly get out there representing my community, and I want them to respect the people they come in contact with.
Maria Haberfeld, I'd like to ask you about something that we've touched on a little bit, but we haven't talked in great detail about the use of deadly force. I mean, when police officers around the world are trained to actually take out a weapon and maybe have to use it, how different are the standards for that in America than in other countries?
Well, first of all, not all police forces around the world are armed. And, you know, the perfect example would be the Irish police force and also the UK. Most of the police officers in UK are not armed as well. Many countries where police officers are armed require actually warning shots. So you have to first, you know, you don't aim at center mass like in the United States. The police officers are trained to aim at center mass. In other countries, they train to shoot, to aim at arms and legs, which is very difficult. I'm not necessarily endorsing this, but there are warning shots that they do not necessarily shoot in the direction of the suspect, and then after the warning shots, they shoot in other areas of the body. But, you know, there are a lot of downsides to this. It's really dangerous in the sense that if you decided that you're going to use deadly force against somebody and you do not eliminate the threat or minimize the threat as soon as possible, then it enhances the chances of you or somebody else is being hurt.
And Maria, you said this earlier, too, in some of the other countries where police are not armed or are armed in a different way, there frankly just aren't as many weapons on the streets. I mean, more individuals in America have guns than in many or most other countries. That might lead police to have different sorts of tactics than here in the United States than in other countries, right?
Well, absolutely, but it's also a matter of perception. You know, police officers here in the United States are very acutely aware of the fact that anybody can be armed and anything can happen on the street, and this is, you know, a realistic perception of the situation as opposed to other countries around the world where this is a rarity. Not that criminals are not armed there, but we cannot compare it. Statistically, we absolutely are facing, you know, a completely different environment here than any police force around the world.
Anthony Salvatore, quickly, could you just enumerate how you train your officers in the use of deadly force? Obviously, it's a very complex issue, but When would you tell an officer, now is the time that you draw your weapon? Now is the time when you might engage your weapon when you feel a threat or you feel like you might need it in the course of performing your duties?
As previously stated, when the officer feels that his life or the life of another may be endangered, they have a right to pull their weapon and use it if the situation dictates.
So that, much like the question we raised earlier about respect, is a murky distinction that may be different for everyone. When I feel my life might be threatened, might be different from when you feel your life might be threatened. Is that a standard that is frankly impossible to really teach on a person by person basis, since it's so different for everyone?
No, not really. And the Supreme Court's come out on appropriate use of deadly force. In some situations, you're correct that it's in the mind of the officer. But that officer has then to be able to articulate what occurred and why such action was taken. And thorough investigations are, at least here in Connecticut, are investigated. And, you know, and the conclusions made as required by law through the Chief State's Attorney's Office for an independent investigation into the use of deadly force in that case.
There's a lot more we can talk about, but we have run low on time. Anthony Salvatore is Chief of Police for the Town of Cromwell. He's also Chairman of the Police Officer Standards and Training Council for the State of Connecticut. Thank you so much, sir, for coming in. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
I also want to thank our guests, Dennis Tuller, who's a retired police lieutenant and police trainer, and Dr. Maria Haberfeld from the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City. Coming up this afternoon at 1 o'clock on the Colin McEnroe Show, Doug Glanville, the former Major League Baseball player, is going to be joining Colin to talk about a law that actually has his name on it that's going through the State General Assembly. It has to do with racial profiling. That's this afternoon at 1 o'clock on the Colin McEnroe Show. When we come back, Emily Badger from the Washington Post talks to us about how Baltimore became Baltimore. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, why is it that men continue to dominate the upper tiers of the business world? We'll talk to the author of Challenging Boardroom Homogeneity, Corporate Law, Governance, and Diversity. We'll also consider the effects of teacher diversity on student success in the classroom. That's tomorrow's Where We Live. Today, the long, painful, and repetitive history of how Baltimore became Baltimore. That's the story Emily Badger recently told in a piece for the Washington Post's Wonk blog. She joins us now from a studio at the Post to tell us more about that story. And Emily, welcome back to Where We Live. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
So how did Baltimore get to be so deeply and racially unequal?
So the story of what's happened in Baltimore over many years, many decades, is very similar to the story that's played out in a lot of American cities. We've had sort of systematic disinvestment and disadvantage in these communities in ways that has been created by public policies on the part of governments. I'm talking about the federal government, local government, all kinds of institutions like banks. And, you know, we've done things like back in the 1930s and 1940s, people who lived in these neighborhoods were denied the right to get a mortgage, to buy a home. Cities built highways through these neighborhoods in ways that really sort of tore them apart. These same neighborhoods were really kind of destroyed and ripped apart in the years that followed that by the rise of mass incarceration, by the drug war, by the subprime lending practice, where a lot of banks went in there and gave people a chance to finally buy a home, but with a mortgage that was going to get them into a lot of trouble. So part of the reason why these places are so deeply poor today and why people have such a lack of opportunity really has to do with this long history of specific policies that we we've done to harm these places. And, you know, I think this is what we need to sort of have a reckoning with right now, is sort of recognizing all of the ways that the rest of society is very responsible for creating these urban ghettos.
You know, as you say, every single thing that you just laid out about Baltimore, you really could apply it to Hartford, Connecticut, whether it's systematic racial segregation, whether or not it has to do with the way crime has been policed. You see this in Baltimore and you see it in other American cities. What are some things that maybe sets Baltimore apart, though, that makes it a little different, the place that we're seeing today with the violence, the unrest, and certainly the mistrust between the authorities and the citizenry?
Well, the sort of latest chapter in all of these events that I'm talking about is this issue of sort of police brutality and police-community relations. And I think it sort of feels in Baltimore as if it's sort of a last straw. You know, you've been living in this community. You feel like you have no opportunity, like everyone is trying to sort of take opportunity away from you. And then, you know, the last straw is feeling like police who are supposed to be there to protect you are actually out to sort of harm people in your community. So, you know, where this issue of police community relations is really flaring up, I think, is you know, piling on top of this very long history and, you know, really sort of bringing a lot of these other issues that have been building over years finally to the fore. So, you know, I think this is playing out in Baltimore right now because we've had one of these really terrible incidences that's prompting this conversation. But I don't think that this is unique to Baltimore. I think, you know, perhaps it's arriving there first. It arrived in Cleveland, it arrived in Ferguson, it arrived to a certain extent in New York. But because these same issues that I'm talking about have existed and existed for a very long time in many communities, I feel very much like, you know, the thing that we're experiencing in Baltimore right now, I would not be surprised if we saw it in other cities as well in the near future.
Of course, that history that you say goes back to the 30s and 40s. I mean, it's racial segregation policies that truly carved up Baltimore in a way that plays out today. And that's something, Emily Badger, that I think a lot of people don't really understand. Many people look at current urban policies and say that's what's to blame or that's what's trying to fix a problem. But when you have something that's been entrenched for 70, 80 years, it really is hard to break a cycle when something's been around that long.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, I've heard from a lot of readers over the last week or so who've said to me, you know, there's more per capita spending on students in the Baltimore public school system than just about any other large public school system in America. So, you know, how could there possibly be a problem there if we're spending so much money on these kids? And, you know, that's I don't want to take away from the fact that this is, you know, this is statistically true with the amount of money that they're spending on children there. But you can't just put money into a public school system, you know, in 2015 and think that negates this very long history of sort of systematic disadvantage. I mean, we're talking about the fact that there's very little job opportunity in these communities. We're talking about the fact that there's a very high incidence of single-parent families in these communities, specifically because the men in them have been incarcerated at very high rates, because it's very difficult for men to find good jobs, and so they tend not to be marriageable if you're a woman looking for someone to marry. I mean, all of these very sort of deeply rooted things influence the structure of opportunity, the structure of families, literally the fabric of these communities. When I'm talking about, for instance, highways having been plowed right through the middle of them, breaking them apart. I mean, these are all things that are so deeply embedded that you're exactly right. I mean, we can't sort of throw one program at a neighborhood like this or throw a certain amount of money at a classroom and think that is going to take care of something that's been building for decades.
Yeah, you mentioned in your article, and you talked about this earlier, the infrastructure from 1951 to 1971, 80 to 90% of the 25,000 families displaced in Baltimore to build new highways, schools, and housing projects were African American. Essentially, you were taking just a heart of a city and carving it out for road projects and then wondering why the city seems as though it's actually split apart.
Right. One of the most amazing statistics that I learned from a researcher in Baltimore is that some of these communities used to have dozens of little parks in them, what we would call kind of pocket parks. And literally 100% of those little parks that were dotting these communities were taken away by highway construction. You know, they were bulldozed in order to run these highways through. And a lot of times we're talking about building highways so that, you know, upper income white people who moved out of the city during white flight could sort of commute in and out of their jobs. But, you know, I think that sort of says a lot about the fabric of a community where, you know, literally the public, the rest of society decides we're going to destroy your community. We don't think that you need to have parks in your community because what's more important is that we put this highway here in order to enable people to drive back and forth to the suburbs and to communities where you don't get to live.
We just have a couple of minutes left, Emily, but I have to ask you about something that has been troubling me, actually, for the last couple of weeks. We talked about this on a program last week. President Obama has famously said that he's a big fan of the crime program on HBO, The Wire, which is, of course, about drug dealing and police activity in Baltimore. I feel as though there's this sort of voyeuristic aspect of us all watching a great American city kind of crumble in this way over the years and using it for entertainment. And then a few years later, when there's riots, we look at it and say, well, I can't believe that this is all happening here in Baltimore. There's just something unseemly about it, especially when we hear about it from the president. I don't know quite where to place that in our conversation, but it just keeps coming back to me over and over again that this seemingly is an American city that we know an awful lot about, and because it's come up from a cop drama.
Right. Well, I mean, I think the voyeurism aspect has a lot to do with whether or not we recognize that we, and by we, I just sort of mean, you know, the public at large, played a role in creating all of these forces and creating these neighborhoods. I mean, if you're just watching this from afar and you think that this has nothing to do with you, you know, this, you think this has nothing to do with your federal government or the banks that you use or the advantage that you have that other people don't have, you know, it feels very far removed. But what I'm suggesting is that, you know, the problems caused in this place, the problems that exist here were caused by lots of different people who have not taken responsibility for that. And it's not enough to just say, you know, the people who live in these communities need to fix their problems themselves. And, you know, babies need to stop having babies and dads need to take responsibility for their kids. Like, that's not the end of the story. Like, this is something that everyone needs to be involved in and take responsibility for.
And we see this, as you said earlier, happening in cities across America. I guess I'm wondering, as we close, Emily, if you see any sort of attraction building, whether it's in Washington or elsewhere, to look more substantively at these issues, because these things are happening in Baltimore, but all the same fact patterns you just talked about certainly have been true over the course of the last century in Hartford, Connecticut, but they're happening in Atlanta, in Chicago, in other cities where there's a lot of crime, there's a lot of violence, and there's a lot of people growing up without opportunity. Do you see some sort of movement out of Washington that says, you know, we have to address this in a way other than just saying, well, let's declare a state of emergency in Baltimore and then move on to the next state of emergency?
You know, I do feel really sort of encouraged about the fact that lots of people are talking about these issues right now. But one of the other things that I'm reminded from in history is that we had a very similar conversation in the 1960s after the riots that followed Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination. And in fact, the federal government, Lyndon Johnson, appointed a commission to sort of say, let's try to figure out what the causes of these riots were and what the causes of racial unrest were. And the commission that came out of that, in fact, did a fantastic job. And they said a lot of really thoughtful things about how there's systematic disadvantage and lack of opportunity in these communities, about how we're aiming in America towards two separate and unequal societies of black and white. And, you know, but a lot of those things that were said 50 years ago about black communities in America are still true today. So I've seen it happen historically that, you know, we've had sort of a moment of thoughtfulness and reckoning, but then clearly we didn't follow through on it. And, you know, I think we should all sort of be on alert to make sure if we care about this, that we actually follow through on it this time.
Emily Badger is a reporter covering urban policy for the Washington Post's Wonk blog. She wrote a piece about how Baltimore became Baltimore. It tells us a lot about not just that city, but a lot of other American cities, including the ones that we have right here in Connecticut. Emily, as always, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Our program produced by Lydia Brown, Tucker Ives, Betsy Kaplan, and Kyle Wolf. Our digital editor is Heather Brandon. The executive producer of Where We Live is Katie Tolarski. Continue this conversation on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live.